Hi, this is Tom Winifrith with my second coronavirus podcast postcard from the Welsh Hovel, the last house in the last village in Wales before we get over the border to England. Thank you for all the best wishes sent about my daughter Olaf, who seems almost certain to have had the coronavirus. She started coming down with symptoms exactly 8 days ago. And the good news to report is from the London mansion where she lives with my ex-wife, Big Nose. The good news is that Olaf seems to have made a more or less full recovery. Of course, she's a healthy young woman. I say healthy because she was born very prematurely. She has some sort of lung issues, but she plays a lot of sport and is pretty fit. Notwithstanding her heavy drinking whilst at university, and therefore you would expect that she would pull through. She says it was like having a very bad hangover for 6 or 7 days, but boasts that she's had far worse hangovers during the previous 2 terms at university. From what I can gather, I can believe that. The good news, of course, is that she has pulled through, and nearly everybody her age will pull through, and indeed people much older. But anyhow, thank you for her wishes. What does the tale of Olaf tell us? Well, the first is that the government, in fact, no one has any clue whatsoever about the number of cases in this country. No clue whatsoever. I was having a debate with a fellow stock market anorak on Twitter, and he managed to come up with a statistical analysis suggesting that within 18 days' time, there could be 2.8 million of us infected in this country. I'm not sure if that is the number within 18 days, but who knows? The spread is certainly very rapid, and the number who are currently infected is, I am sure, closer to 100,000 than to the stated number of 3,000. An awful lot closer to 100,000. The government itself, a week ago, admitted that there could be as many as 50,000 cases in the UK, and the number of cases seems to be doubling every 3 days. Well, of course it's not. All we know is the number of people who've been tested positive are doubling every 3 days. That is no indication of the number of cases. Olaf was never tested. She had all the symptoms. The college which she goes to, it's Oxford. Queen's appears to be a bit of a hot spot. Indeed, Oxford generally is a bit of a hot spot for the coronavirus. So everything would indicate that she did have it, but she was never tested. She called 111, her mother called 111, and eventually got through to someone who suggested that she almost certainly had it. But she is not in the statistics. There are a lot of people I know who have symptoms or who have family members with symptoms who are isolating. You hear reports of folks, teachers at schools around the country, schools saying, we have 2 or 3 teachers off, we have 4 or 5 teachers off, because either they or a family member are self-isolating. And you see this in every line of business which you go to. They're self-isolating not for fear, but self-isolating because there is an infection within the family. And not a tested one, but nonetheless an infection. The Olivia case does beg the question, who else did she infect before she went into isolation? There was a period of 24 hours between her starting to go down with symptoms and her starting isolation. Who did she infect? She doesn't know. They don't know. There has been no tracing because there has been no testing. We are in this country not doing what folks did in other countries who have successfully tackled the disease. The only way we could get some idea of what the spread is to do a reasonably large-scale random sample. If we accept that maybe London is a hotspot, well, let's do a sample in London. Let's just send medics in to test 1,000 people in somewhere where they're going to be reasonably pliant. let us say, Richmond, and we test them now. We get the results back, and then we will have an idea of the spread of the disease in the population. 1,000 should be a fairly representative sample. And then we test them again in a week's time, and again a week after that. That would give us some idea of how the disease is spreading. But let me give you a contrary point of view. And it is one that I don't think many people are daring to say, which is that we've got this all wrong. And it's partly because of society's attitude to death. We're terrified of it. We try and postpone it. Moreover, we spend vast amounts forcing people to live longer, people who wouldn't necessarily want to live longer. Do you know how many people die each year in the UK? The real number, it's about 600,000. The government said that under its previous plan, there would have been 250,000 people dying of the coronavirus. Under the current plan, the new current plan, it hopes to get the number down to between 5,000 and 20,000. But what it's not telling you, and what there's no study of, and we won't know until this whole thing is over, is how many of those 5 or 20,000 or 250,000 would have popped their clogs anyway? I put it to you that the answer is the vast, vast majority, perhaps 80 or 90%. If you look at the statistics from Italy, you will see that even in my age group, that is the 50 to 59s, the percent mortality rate, those who get the disease and then die, is just 0.6%. When you get into the 60s, it's 4% or whatever. The 70s, 8%. The 80s, 9%, 12%. And over 90, it's 19%. Those are the rough numbers. People below my age group, people below 50, it's more or less nothing. And even those who do die within my age group invariably have underlying health problems as well. In most cases, far worse than my own, diabetes, which is causing me to stay away from people. But far worse than that, they have had major heart problems. They have had major cancer. They are immunosuppressed. Maybe they've had a lifetime of smoking, especially in Italy, and their lungs are ripped to shreds already. They have underlying health issues. So the sort of people who are dying, touch wood, I don't want to die quite yet, except I will one day. The sort of people who are dying in every age category are those who are very, very likely to have died in the current year anyway. They were poor statistical bets. We spend a fortune in this country on folks in the last couple of years of their life, desperately keeping them going in a way that we wouldn't have done 50 years ago. And often the quality of life of those people is really very poor indeed. I have conversations with my father, who has been bedridden for 8 months. He has various cancers and is in a pretty poor state. He has said he wants to get the coronavirus. I've said, Dad, it would be, a bit of a pain for your carers, a pain for the health service. It's got one or two other things on its mind at the moment. So perhaps if you could do things like not inviting Olivia to come and stay with you and do your best not to get it. And he accepts that point of view. But his quality of life is so poor. 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago, I very much doubt he would have lasted as long as he had now. He's had treatment and care. But he is the sort of person, and he knows it, who, if the coronavirus makes contact with, his chances are very remote indeed. What I'm trying to say in this is all the efforts we've made, all the incredibly restrictive measures we have made, and all of the economic disruption which we're making and which is happening around the world, what is going to be the net saving of lives? I put it to you, it will be probably very small indeed. I was taken by an interview yesterday with a German MEP and also a retired physician who's now actually doing the decent thing and going back into the front line, as I should say, is my local MP here in Wrexham, Sarah Atherton, who has many faults, but she's going back to work as a nurse, and I take my hat off to her for that. I hope I don't encounter her professionally over the next few weeks, but hat off to her. The German MP was asked on Channel 4 News. He was asked why it is that the mortality rate in Germany is so low. The interviewer, Matt Fry, was desperately trying to goad the guy and saying, it's because Germany has great facilities, whereas your NHS has been fucked by years of Tory austerity. The German MEP was having none of that, pointing out, yes, Germany had many more critical care beds than the NHS does currently, but at the moment, relatively few of them are used. Capacity is not an issue in Germany and is not yet an issue in the NHS. So comparing mortality rates in Germany, which are lower than they are in the UK, it is nothing to do with the wicked Tories and underspending on the NHS. The German MEP made two points. One, Germany has done far more testing than the UK, and therefore the mortality rate is not a reflection so much on the number of people dying, but on the fact that they now have a better idea of how many people have the virus in the first place than we do in the UK. The denominator is that much greater. It is not necessarily because the Germans have more cases. It is just that they have more recorded cases. The second point that the German MEP made was that an awful lot of the krauts who'd caught the coronavirus had done so while they had been skiing in northern Italy and Austria. They were therefore an almost self-selecting sample of people who were relatively fit. Folks like my dad, well, their skiing days are behind them. Most of the person who died in our local hospital here in Wrexham, I think she was 97 and she had underlying health issues. She is not the sort of person who goes skiing. So a disproportionate number of the Germans who went were who've caught it were relatively fit and healthy individuals. Whereas in the UK, a lower number are fit and healthy individuals, a greater number are old folks, and therefore we will have a higher mortality rate. My point, therefore, is that when we get the virus spreading into the wider population, I think you'll find that the UK mortality rate is likely to fall to being closer to the German mortality rate. And again, largely the number of people who are killed will be people who were going to die anyway within the next 12 months. We've just brought it forward a little bit. Folks talk about how the flu virus kills 8,000 people a year, and we should put that into the context of coronavirus. That 8,000 number is not actually how many people in the United Kingdom die of flu each year. The number of people who die of flu is far, far higher. I think it's well over 100,000. The 8,000 is the number of people who die of flu in an especially bad flu season, the additional deaths. And again, those who are most likely to succumb to flu, the additional deaths, are those who are immunocompromised, partially as a result of other conditions, partially as a result of old age. All of this goes back to the point that the enormous measures, the total disruptions to the economy, economies of the West that we are seeing as a result of the coronavirus, outside of Italy, the disruptions, all they're doing is perhaps postponing deaths that would have happened in the relatively near-term future. Yes, there will be some additional deaths from COVID. There will be some folks who were not immunocompromised, didn't have health issues, weren't terribly old, and they are unfortunate casualties. But there probably won't be that many of them. Folks talk, by the way, about doctors in China who caught the virus and died. Well, relatively young doctors. And part of that, one suspects, is the fact that they were working 36-hour shifts and then having a short break. And they were working under phenomenal pressure. and they were working phenomenal hours. And that sort of behaviour also serves to compromise your immune system and therefore made them vulnerable. I don't read too much into that. I may be wrong. The conversation which we're not having, and I think we should be having, but I don't think anyone's brave enough to suggest we have, is the conversation with folks who are vulnerable to coronavirus about their deaths. Now, I don't wish to sound like Harold Shipman here or Dr. Death, but the conversation is how selfless are you going to be and what are your wishes? It's very rare, it's very difficult to have a conversation with one's parent. Do you want to die? I'm very glad that my dad has raised it himself. It saved me raising it or my sisters raising it. This is something Dad has expressly wished, that should he get struck down with absolutely anything, he wants to be let go. He has a living will, and actually, of course, he's now gone further with his desire to meet the coronavirus. If there's anyone in the South Warwickshire area who's just recently returned from Italy, my dad would love to meet you, but don't you dare go. That's his wish. It's not something I wish for. But the conversation I think we should all be having with such people is what happens if you do get the coronavirus? Do you, as an 87-year-old with underlying health conditions, knowing that your chances aren't good, do you really wish to clog up a hospital bed, a bed which could perhaps be used for someone who has a greater chance of survival than you? You've had a good knock. You know that the odds are you're going to go relatively soon anyway, and perhaps this could be a sort of relatively quick way of going, and we can handle it well for you. These are the conversations I think people should be having with their GPs if they perceive that they are vulnerable, if they are a high-risk group. Is, yes, Mr. GP, you know, I don't want to go to hospital. Is there a way that I can stay at home and receive palliative care, enough morphine to knock me out, bottles of whiskey, whatever? Is there a way that I can do that? If I pull through, great. If I don't pull through, I have at least freed up the health service for someone with a very good chance of doing it, and I've had a very good knock anyway. I think we'd be surprised at the number of people who are very, very elderly who'd say, actually, you know, I've had a good knock. I don't wish to fight for life at this particular time should I be struck by the coronavirus. If we could get large numbers or even modest numbers of people making that selfless but perhaps selfish gesture, they just don't want to struggle on for those last couple of years of having to have your teeth brushed and your bottom wiped by others, and they know that they're not going to last that long anyway. If we get a large number of people doing that, it will relieve the burden on the health service, allowing them to fight for more marginal, for better cases, and to try and haul them through. It is a conversation I think the nation's doctors need to have with their patients. Of course, people like Dr. Shipman would have had it very enthusiastically. This is a very difficult subject for them to raise, and I'd hope that a number of patients raise it with their doctors. That, I think, should be the conversation we're having. We also do need to think, and it will only become apparent in a year's time when we have full data, we will see just how many additional lives were saved by the government's actions and the actions of governments across the West, which have train wrecked the economies. And don't be kidding, the measures taken by the Chancellor may stop an imminent economic collapse, but they will cause other issues going forward. Medication for the economy always causes other issues. My suspicion is that we are going to get a hyperinflation at some stage. There's a very real risk if you print so much money that you do get hyperinflation, which of course will create another asset bubble. It will steal from the young and give to the old. It will steal from the poor who don't benefit from an asset bubble and give to the wealthy, those who are asset rich. Is that really desirable? That is what's going to happen in the long run. Was all of this necessary? How many extra deaths caused by COVID, will what has happened actually save? I put it to you that the number will probably end up being relatively small. Having said all of that, I have my concerns, but I'm obeying government orders. I'm in a higher risk group, marginally, as is the missus, and therefore we self-isolate. I did the last pick and collect, pick up from Tesco today, keeping my distance from everyone, using lots of hand sanitizer, etc. I'm delighted now to be back home. I hope I haven't caught anything. Our local village store is delivering to everyone in the village, avoiding the need for contact. At the bottom of their basket of goods today, it had a message saying, "Thank you, you're a star." We're stars for self-isolating. Well, no, they're the real stars. They are the people who show real spirit, and they will be rewarded. Capitalism will reward them for, I can guarantee that when this is all over, there'll be a lot of folks who used to go and save a few quid by shopping at Tesco who will return the loyalty by now shopping in the village store, paying a little bit more, but making sure we retain this invaluable asset for the whole community. That is it from me. I'll do another podcast when I have a few more thoughts. Don't be too offended by what I said. Keep safe.